Accession number 4488, Reel 6.
Brigadier O'Flynn, Reel 6. What sort of equipment did the individual soldier carry with him?
Well, first of all, the orders of dress of the soldier. There were several different orders of dress. There was the parade dress, a smart parade dress, was the black kalpak, which is an astrakhan hat which sits on the top. And in the case of the officers, the rank of the officer was denoted by the bit that came down on the side, the number of gold sheets you have. If it's interesting to you, I can let you have a little model I have of a soldier depicting the uniform. Now, on the upmost, they had a thing called the kirtar, which was a khaki-coloured jacket, which below the waist was a sort of skirt thing. And as far as the cavalry were concerned, the lower part contained riding breeches, dark blue puttees and black boots. As far as the trooper, or the jalundi is the Arabic word called, the trooper concerned in the mechanized squadrons, he wore the khaki plus four over his black puttees. And around the waist, they wore the red cummerbund. Above that, they wore leather belts and leather bandoliers over the shoulder. Now, as far as I can remember, the leather bandolier carried about, I think it was close on 100 rounds. They were very well armed, bristling with bullets. And, of course, that the rifle carried by the infantryman, and the bayonet and scabbard also carried by the infantryman. Now, in the cavalry squadrons, there was a slight difference, because there they had both sabres and rifles, and whereas the mechanized squadrons had Lewis guns, the cavalry had Hotchkiss guns in what they call a Hotchkiss troop. And of course, in the infantry, in the mechanized squadrons, we also had two Vickers machine guns per troop. And the Vickers machine gun, I think we had actually carried on the ground six boxes, which meant six additional belts. Now, perhaps I ought to follow from here is what we did when we dismounted. Now, on the troop carrier, of course, all these arms and weapons were carried in the body of the vehicle, except the rifle, which was carried in a little rifle rest aside each rifleman, the five riflemen. The driver and the co-driver had rifle racks above their heads, horizontal to the ground. The officer carried a pistol, and the two machine gunners carried pistols. So, and of course, whenever we went in the desert, we had to carry our full composition of arms. So at all times, we were ready for action. The only difference being that on normal occasions, we didn't allow anybody to have a really light rifle in case it went off by mistake. So there were the weapons. Now, in addition to that, everybody, instead of having a water bottle, as they do in the British Army, we carried a goatskin called a shagul, which had to be kept very moist, which kept the water inside cool. As far as I remember, the shagul carried about a half a gallon of water. And when in motion, the shagul was also carried on a little hook alongside where the chap sat. And behind in the back, we also had a number of cans, the predecessor of the jerry can, I think, carried with gallons. Because on patrol, a chap was only allowed half a gallon of water a day, which had to cover all purposes. And I think it is for that reason, no doubt you'll come on to it later, that when we went in the desert, I don't ever remember taking the chaps out for more than 3 days, because it was the problem of water, really, that made us go back.
Did you keep the same equipment for your whole time in the Transjordan Frontier Force?
No, I joined the Frontier Force in the period, the second period of change, because until 1930, the Frontier Force, when it first formed, was organized into three cavalry squadrons and one camel squadron. Well, in 1932, as a result of operational experience, and also the general trend to mechanize the army and the colonial forces, a tendency had come in to make use of the internal combustion engine. And it had been found that the camels, although very useful, were not really adequate for the purpose for which the mechanized squadron came into being, which was to look after the eastern part of Transjordan, to the east of the railway which ran from Daraa down to Marne, and a bit before that, in the days of Lawrence, beyond Marne, to the eastern frontier. And so D Squadron became the first mechanized squadron. Oh, it started to change and become a mechanized squadron. And a new squadron, M Squadron, was formed from the outset to be a mechanized squadron. Now, up to the time when I joined, the mechanized squadron was really only mechanized in the sense it carried infantry to the point where they had to dismount to go into action. And I went out at the time when it had already been decided at the preliminary trial to further mechanize the mechanized squadrons by making one of the troops a light armed troop. And this was to be done by replacing the Crossley troop carriers in the second troop in each half squadron, and replacing the vehicles by three comma light armed cars, which was really a comma chassis carrying about a 1 ton or 30 hundredweight load. And the load was to be a platform which could carry four soldiers in the back, and in the centre, where in an armoured car would have been a turret, a mounting which would carry a Mark V Vickers machine gun, and a mounting which enabled it to swing around a 360 degree traverse to provide fire on the move is necessary. In other words, to carry out the tasks of an armoured car without the armour.
So the men who travelled in it weren't protected at all?
No, they were not protected. This was the beginning. Although, towards the end of my time, a device did come out, which was to put armour round the turret, but it didn't arrive in my time. So it was early in the middle of 1933, that each troop, one troop in each half squadron became the light armed troop, and the eventual intention was, but was not fulfilled in my time, was to replace the Crossley troop carrier, which a very heavy, sluggish vehicle in the desert, especially where one came across much soft sand, that was to be replaced by a comma troop carrier, which could also carry 12 men at the back, and three benches, one behind the other, facing forward. Of course, it had the disadvantage, and it would not have been able to carry more stuff, as much stuff, as a Crossley did. But I had no experience of that. Although I see in some of my pictures that I did have one or two of these vehicles, I think on trial use, when I was in the Jordan Valley in 1936.
But in Zirka, you were using the Crossley.
The Crossley, and yes.
Can you describe the everyday routine of barrack life in Zirka?
Yes. It was much like any other military establishment at that time. First of all, there was a slight change in the days of working. We were now in an Arab country, therefore Friday was a holy day. And so Friday was a holiday. And of course also the Christians maintained Sunday and the Jews maintained Saturday. So as far as the life was concerned, The working days were Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday for everybody. Friday was a non-work day for everybody. The Jews didn't work on Saturdays. And Sunday was also a holiday because the village didn't work. So that was the basic routine. Otherwise, now then, in Zirka at that time, there was one cavalry squadron which stayed out there for 1 year and then replaced one of the two squadrons in the Jordan Valley in rotation. There was one mechanized squadron which stayed in Zirka for 2 years and then alternated with the other mechanized squadron in Marne for 2 years. There was also the depot there because everybody joined the Transjordan Frontier Course, and you had to name the race you found him in the Transjordan Frontier Force. Although 80% of them, I think, were Arabs or of Arab descent. And by Arabs, I include Sudanese, a few Egyptians, Druzes, Chickenese, or what they called them. I've got the wrong name on something like that. It's Aidanese, a whole variety of Arab races. In fact, the one or two chaps in my own half squadron who were not very good in making themselves understood in the Arab queues in Palestine.
Do you know how the force went around recruiting local troops?
There was never any shortage of recruits. They used to come in from the Palestine villages and from the Bedouin. There was a very strict selection procedure. This was carried out by the Qa'i, the senior Arab local officer. And initially when I went out there, his assistant was Noel Caspi, the Jew, who came to M Squadron. And some very excellent Arab instructors. There was also, I think, one British warrant officer there who was a cavalryman, who used to be the chief instructor. But they had a very tough training. The Arab is a tougher chap than we are. And as far as I remember, they did a training lasting about 3 months, and also when I was there, that education had started, because there were a large number of Arabs when I was there who could neither read nor write, and so a program had started by the time I went out there to try to start to teach them to read and to write. But this had certain complications, because the question was, what were they going to read and what were they going to write? Then there was also a hospital there, most efficiently run by an officer from the RAMC, and the whole of the time I was there, a very able Arab officer, who was a doctor, who I think had been trained in the Lebanon. There was also the remount depot, was a house which was trained, and a veterinary hospital.
Was there a predominance of any particular type among the native recruits?
Well, most of them were Arabs, but then, you see, it's a very different world to explain today, because there was no shortage of recruits. The Frontier Force had a reputation. And you got a large number of Bedouin Arabs who were anxious to be associated with this Imperial Force, and there were a large number of wandering people who used to come along and try to join the Frontier Force. Now, these would be immigrants from different parts of the world. As I said just now, I had a Jewish driver who'd come from, I think, Poland originally. Why he'd come from Poland, I don't know. But there was no shortage of recruits. And what used to happen was, chaps used to come and want to join, and their names would be taken. They'd have an examination, physical, medical, and other things. And the force was very particular, because they didn't just take a recruit and start training tomorrow. I think their recruit period, training period, started about every 6 weeks or so. And so if a suitable chap came along and he'd passed the vetting, as I say, vetting in the sense that he was physically fit, he seemed to be intelligent enough, and those sorts of things, then he was recruited, and he stayed about for 6 weeks until there was the 30 or so chaps in the place, to allow a recruit squad to commence. But there was never any shortage. We had an establishment, I can't remember the number now, I think about 840, but like all units at the treasury, the local treasury, allot so much money which cannot be exceeded. And we were not allowed to exceed that. And the chap, having been trained at the recruit depot for 3 months or so, would then be posted to a squadron when he'd passed his training.
What sort of training did the recruits go through?
Well, there was a basic military training, drill, weapon training, physical training. And when I was a certain educational standard of training had started. And, of course, then the chaps who were going to ride had to be taught to ride horses and to groom horses. And there were also a number of people selected for training as drivers, because at that time, remember, it was a comparatively new thing out there. But the basic driver training was always carried out at the depot before coming to the mechanized squadrons. We had to sort of improve the standard. And also, I think all the driving and maintenance mechanical training had to be done in the squadron.
How
there
did they
no
adapt?
Shortage. But this question, another thing has come up in those days. There was no such thing as unemployment, because the Arab, in those were the Arab world, you see, they all managed to get some sort of job somehow. And even if they couldn't get a job, a chap would suddenly appear and try to sell you tea or make tea and things like that. But no, but there was no difficulty, because the force had a reputation.
What do you think attracted them to the force?
I think the glamour of being soldiers, having weapons. Because every Arab tried to have his own weapon. And being able to have a weapon, because every man had his personal weapon in the frontier force. It wasn't his own weapon, it was state weapon. But it was carried in his barrack room, and it was kept in the barrack room in racks, always locked. The man under the room orderly always had the key of the lock. But every man had his own rifle, he had to clean it. It became his own, more or less, personal fess. This, I think, was a great attraction. Also, I think it was a question of the life they led, because in their own villages they were looked up to. The chap went home to a village on leave and he wore his uniform. He usually came back with two or three buddies who wanted to join the frontier force. And it went far and wide. I had my initial orderly, who was recruited for me, a man called Mohammed Madris, had been an Idrisi from Egypt. And he was one of the sort of the sons of one of the wealthy Idris family. And when he left, his replacement was the most wonderful Sudanese soldier called Ali Hussein, who'd come all the way up from the Sudan. And he'd been in the force for 6 years, and when another officer left, he wanted to come and join me, and he did. And when I left, he served on to train to look after my successor. But there was no shortage of recruits in those days. I think it was they wanted to be soldiers. The martial spirit is there. And I think it's very interesting to realize that perhaps I'm sticking my neck out, but I think it's the large number of people we recruited in my day from the desert, the Badu, the true Badu, who subsequently became the main stream of this very fine Jordanian army they have, which has the most magnificent tank regiments now.
When you first arrived in Zirka, you were put straight in charge of a half squadron. How did you find the men when you first met them?
Well, the first afternoon, having had a long chat with Chota and Ian Fernie showing me around my new command, I then met Hamdi Beck and Bogdanovich, and then I met the sergeants, Rustam Shaka, and for the life of me, the second sergeant, name repeated. And they were magnificent chaps. They took me round, and I didn't know any Arabic in those days, and they knew very, very English. But however, I met every single soldier and shook him by the hands and got to know his face. And then from Ian Fernie, we were both in Zirka for the first week. He wasn't going out on patrol, and so I spent most of the mornings with him, and he took me round and showed me things. But the basic life of a soldier was very simple, because every morning, first parade was at 7 o'clock. In the summer, the very heat of the summer, it became 6 o'clock. And we always had an activity parade before breakfast, which was either a drill parade, a PT parade, a cross-country run, something to wake us all up, because the Arabs are rather like most people, inclined to be a bit sleepy in the morning, especially if they'd been on Arak the night before. And then after breakfast, we always breakfast about 9. The soldiers always fed in the canteen. There was a canteen running in Zirka, in which the soldiers bought their own food. They were also allowed to buy one pound sterling's worth of vouchers, which enabled them to buy food from the canteen. And the canteen was run by a contractor who had to satisfy very stringent requirements.
What sort of things would they buy at this canteen?
Their breakfast, well, the Arab food, which was normally all sorts of smelly stuff. I can't remember what it was now. But they fed more or less as we feed. They didn't have as much meat as we did. A lot of onions, a lot of vegetables. I know it was evil-smelling stuff. And but they were all well fed, because I cannot remember the amount of money they got in those days. But they were paid monthly. And at the monthly pay parade, the half squadron leader was responsible for paying out the soldiers and getting the receipt. In the light of the average Arab, they were very well paid. I can't remember what the sum was, but I know in relation to the British Army, as a second lieutenant, getting 10 and 4 pence, reduced to 9 and 10 pence, I think it was, in the financial crisis of 1931, where everybody had his pay docked, I went to Cairo as a two pipper with 12 and 4 pence a day, to get a princely salary to me of £50 a month, with no tax paid. And it was something like that. The Arab, in relation to his countrymen, was a very well-paid soldier. This perhaps helps to why so many people, especially from the Bedouin tribes, when we became mechanized, start to come into the frontier force. Because, again, we're talking on the recruiting thing, because as the mechanized squadrons, we spent almost our entire time in the desert, between the railway and the frontier. And therefore, one had a lot of contact and communication with the wandering Bedouin. And many of those came to us. And also, a large number of those also went to the Arab Legion. The desert side of the Arab Legion, which we'll have to come on to later. But it was an attractive thing. One wanted to be a soldier in those days. The Arab loves dressing up. And the Trans-Jordan Frontier Force had a very colourful uniform. And even the officers' farm, they used to go to Jerusalem at the King David Hotel and arrive and see the Bedouins there. They used to sort of swoon with delight to see these gorgeous uniforms.
So what sort of things did the Arabs have to pay for out of their pay?
Well, a large number were married. They had to live. The only thing they had to pay the state, not the state, but the contractor, was for their food. And as far as I remember, that I remember being told at that time that most of them didn't have to pay more than about £1 a month for food. It was a cheap country, cheap living. And as far as I can remember, although all soldiers had a bed space in the barrack block, I think about 50 or 60% lived out. There were married quarters provided. There were a limited number of married quarters. But then, of course, there were certain chaps who didn't want to bring their wives down. They enlisted perhaps for 3 years, and they used to go home each year, and then came out. But there was no problem. There were married quarters there, and I don't remember anybody ever protesting about not having a married quarter. And they were generally happy. They were very simple people. One used to see, especially when one went out, we haven't come on to this yet, but But of course, in addition to all our military training, basic training, and all the technical training which one had to start doing when I went out there, our main job was to get to know the desert, to get to know the tribes, be prepared to go out. There were a lot of tribal trouble the year before I went out, but somehow or other, in the year I went out, all the tribal trouble slowed down. Whether it was my arrival, I don't know, but they'd become pacified. But we used to have to go out on things like track marking. Now, the desert is an open space, and if you're going to get anywhere, you've got to know where you're going. And we had to make tracks across the desert. Most of the tracks started either in Zirka, in the north or Marne in the south. Now these tracks were marked on the ground by wheeled vehicles running over them, and every so often across wadis, clearing the way across, canning the way across by building cairns. We were aimed to make a track right across the desert areas of about 18 feet wide. Because remember, after rain, some of the tracks disappeared and others fell away. So we'd like to have an average width of 18 feet. So if a track had been crossed by a vehicle after a heavy rainstorm, leaving deep ruts, well then, as it dried off, there could be a bit on the right. But as I said, once a fortnight, one of the half squadrons would go out. So there was usually a half squadron out each week.
And what sort of things did this involve?
We went out. The whole half squadron went out. Sometimes there were merely visits around the tribes to seeing who was where and what they were doing there. But mostly, whenever we went out, it was a task of repairing a track, maintaining a track, or marking a new track. Because not only did we have to make the tracks, but it was the wheel tracks, but also tie to them up, and also an extensive remarking campaign started when I was out there, where every track had to be given a new number, a cairns built, at 5 and 10 mile intervals from the beginning to the end of the track, and then marked, but every 5 miles, by a heap of stone about 6 feet across and 5 feet high at 5 mile intervals, and at 10 mile intervals a stone cairn of 10 feet high. And alongside these cairns, in large white letters, stones, I think they were about a foot long and 6 inches wide, indicating the letter of the track and the distance from the starting point. Now these were used not only by us on the ground but also by the RAF in the air, because remember, this a big track marking exercise had been carried out a few years before when the Imperial Airways route to Baghdad had been marked right across the Transjordan Desert by 2 armoured cars and a plough. And we were merely carrying on in a simple way this gigantic road system throughout the frontier. And in the north, in Zirka, the aim was to cover each track once every 3 months. And in the south, we had a similar pattern, except in the south, there were far more tracks to be covered, and a great deal of difference in the mileage.
What was the country like around Zirka that you had to cover?
Well, around Zirka, basically flat. When I say basically flat, it wasn't a plain. Zirka was plain, but it rose and fell. There were sandy patches, and there were stone patches, thorny patches, and the occasional hole of water. But originally, the track started by linking up the various water holes. And then there were certain police posts at Bandara, Gawira in the south, and Jaffa in the north, and other places in the middle. And also the tracks had to connect up to the police posts. And so it became a gigantic road system. I have a track map here.
Did you have any maps of any kind to go on when you were doing this?
Yes, well, of course, at that time, there was not an accurate map of that part of the world at all. In fact, the frontier, the eastern frontier, was still not delineated. And so my predecessors had, in the course of time, drawn up rough maps, one of which was on a calico material, I suppose about 36 inches long by about 24 inches wide. But in addition to that, we also had what we call the track card. That was about 18 inches by 10 inches, with the South Transjordan on one side and North Transjordan on the other side. Well, the North Transjordan side was used mainly by the squadron in Marne, the squadron in Zirka, and the south map by the squadron in Marne. Now, on this map, each year, when a new version was issued, with the latest situation about the approximate layout of the various tracks which had been made and where the frontier was. Now, first of all, to start with the frontier. As far as we were concerned, in the mechanized squadrons, the eastern frontier had not been delineated or agreed by anybody. There was an approximate line which was taken going due south from the French sphere, going down whatever it was. And so for the purposes of preventing any trouble or border incidents, a track had been made from the northwest, the northeast of Zirka, right down to the south, the frontier with Nejd, and then west to Wadi Rum to Aqaba, which was regarded, it was TJTEC, was regarded as a frontier we had to abide by. Now, when we went out then, our task, first of all, was to make quite certain we knew how to get about. So my early two expeditions in the desert were with Ian Fernie and his half squadron, so that I could know the essential places I had to know in the north, like Azraq, Baia, and Jaffa oases. And after that, I had to rely upon my own senior Rice, Hundebeck, and Bogdanovich. But we went out on these tracks for several reasons. First of all, we had to get acquainted with the tribes. I can't remember the names now, but I do remember meeting my early days a number of the Hawatat tribe, who had been personal friends of a man they called Jorans. I always had to know, did I know Jorans? It was Lawrence.